Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 2nd of June 2013. My name's T.R.P. Watson, and this week I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Paul in London, Gareth James, Phil from the West End Whingers, and Web Cowgirl. We're now going to talk about Blind Date, which is on at the Charing Cross Theatre. This is an improvised piece by Rebecca Northen. She's a Canadian improviser and first started doing this particular play or piece in 2007. As I understand it, she gets an audience member up and goes on a blind date with them, goes on that first date with them, finds out all about them. It sounds a little bit like something Improbable Theatre did about 10 years ago called Life Story, where they would interview somebody and then improvise bits from his life. I'm not sure it's quite exactly like that, but it's vaguely similar. It absolutely terrifies me. It certainly would terrify me to be in this... be the audience member who's pulled up and interviewed, but that probably tells you why I'm still single. John, what did you think about this?
I thought it was incredible, and I had been a little bit hesitant about going to see it because as a victim of endless Edinburgh Festival improvised musicals and plays where the audience are allowed to shout out suggestions and not very good student drama types make a fist of it, this was just... so far the other end of the accomplishment spectrum that I was really blown away. What happens is that Rebecca Northen and her two assistants, one of whom is actually her brother, trawl the gathering crowd in the bar of the theatre beforehand, and I think they suss out a likely victim. But it's incredibly high risk because the format of the show is she picks one man from the 200 or 300 that are in the theatre. And he is the whole of the rest of the show, 90 minutes improvisation with him completely unprepared. And the fact that it's successful night after night, you know, is a tremendous tribute to her ability, because not only does she have to keep the show moving, but she has to keep him safe as well. And when what they're doing is talking about discovering their personalities and their sexual interests, and the thing starts in a restaurant where they're just having a drink, and then it's allowed to move on more or less wherever the, I won't call him stooge, but wherever the boyfriend of the night takes it. Shall we go for a walk? Shall we go back to my apartment? Shall we go for a drive? All of this has to be improvised, which she does brilliantly with the help of, as I say, just two assistants who play, I don't know, policemen, waiters, doormen, anything that they're called on to do. And they're improvising as well. I think it's an original concept. I'm amazed she's waited so long to bring it to the UK, because it's had tremendous success in Canada and the United States. And I think it's lovely. We were very lucky the night we went to see it that we had a very, very engaging boyfriend. And part of the deal also is that this person has a partner in the audience, in this case his fiance, I think she was, who is allowed to call time out, or rather call bullshit if he says anything that isn't true about himself, or time out if she thinks the date's going too far, too close, too fast, and she's afraid of losing him to Rebecca Northen. So we had a very, very generous girlfriend who didn't like to do that. But another friend of mine went two nights later, and the girlfriend was a complete neurotic and stopped the show every 5 minutes, which was a different sort of experience. But I'm sure Northen still handled it very well. So I'm captivated. She's asked me out for a coffee, so I think I might go, which would be a very peculiar blind date, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, it'd be fascinating to see you on stage with her, John. I know it's not a coffee, but I know it's a coffee, not a show, but interesting, isn't it? I think the other thing is funny, Tim, talking about this show is because we're talking about a show that other people are not going to see because each night is going to be slightly different. But I think I'd agree with John that it's very finely balanced between whatever the sort of the guest, the date decides to do, and the sort of the cast sort of have to balance keeping it real, but also keeping it light and funny and entertaining. I think the thing that might make some people hesitant about going to see it as if they're selected for the show. But obviously, they do some pre-show screening and chatting to people. So if you're just rude and dismissive of them, like we were on the night, they'll leave you alone, I'm sure. I think that's, we were doing that deliberately, weren't we, John?
Who was rude or dismissive? I guess it's any of them.
Yeah, so I think it's an interesting piece, and I think the thing about it is that because it's so improvised and you think, oh, wow, how did they do that? It does make you want to go and see it again or again.
Rebecca Northern's brother, who I've already mentioned, Jamie, occasionally takes the lead and picks a lady from the audience. So there are other dynamics to this that could be very interesting.
Yeah, and I think that's, for me, thinking about it afterwards, is that really part of keeping it all together and just sort of keeping the comedy and from being light and funny and so it doesn't become a bit awkward or anything like that? Like, as you mentioned, we were very lucky the night we saw it that there was a guy that was very easygoing and amiable at any of the suggestions to be able to take part in them. I think that made the show possibly, you know, a lot more fun than it would be any other night. But I suspect that's also he's the sort of person that they would zero in on in the audience and make the most of. Because I guess if you're going to be going to a show, you're not exactly going to be terribly dismissive of any suggestion that's asked of you.
Did you know the full format of the show before you went to see it?
No, but I got a hint of it when I think as the show started to evolve, I was like, okay, that's why they were interviewing people at the beginning and all that sort of thing. I thought, okay, so this is most likely going to be this sort of thing. But yeah, as you said, 90 minutes of improvised theatre, and it could have gone, notwithstanding the various set pieces that they shaped the show around, you know, there's still quite a lot that it could happen. I guess it'd be interesting to go see it on a night when the guy wasn't as involved or didn't, you know, wanted to actually stop participating and see how they work the show then, because obviously it'd be completely different from what we saw.
I think that they're pretty much always 30-something, fairly sort of creative job type, personable young men. I've seen a couple of reviews of the show in other locations, and the arc of the narrative always seems to be about the same. That it starts a little bit unpredictably and a little bit edgily, but the way she controls it is it always has a happy end, and it always blossoms into a very sweet story. Because that's the thing that I took away. Mm. Not just that it was extremely funny all the way through, and the amusement of the unpredictability, but how well she managed it to make it actually romantic.
Yeah. And her own personality comes across in the show as well. And I think it's quite an achievement to actually make something that is quite uncertain at the beginning become something that is so sweet.
And how can she guarantee to seduce a man every night? Because she had this lovely rapport with the guy I saw, this guy Barty. And she had a great way of looking very directly at him and smiling, which, you know, is exactly what works on a date.
Yeah.
It was very, very convincing that she was falling for him. And I wonder if he was a little bit convinced by it too. And like I say, it's very, very cleverly managed. I would certainly go and see it again. I think go with no preconceptions, even from what we've said, about what it's going to be like. And I'm sure you'll have a great time.
And if you don't want to be a member of it, just don't talk to anybody. Yes, just be slightly rude.
We're now going to talk about Disgraced at the Bush Theatre. This is a 2013 Pulitzer Prize for Drama winning play by Iyad Akhtar. It stars Kirsty Bushell, Harry Dillon, Sarah Powell, Nigel Whitmey and Danny Ashok. It centres on a corporate lawyer called Amir Kapoor and his artist wife Emily. They have a plush apartment in the Upper East Side. Amir is sort of living kind of a double life because although he is a Muslim, his name is not a specifically Muslim name. It's a sort of more an Indian sounding name. He's chosen the name Kapoor. He has a young nephew who has given himself a very Western sounding name, although his real name is Hussein. He's kind of living a lie, and I've begins to fall apart for him when he shows support for a suspect imam at a mosque at the urging of his nephew and indeed his wife, who is fascinated by Islamic art and seems almost an apologist for Islam, which he isn't really. He's rather worried about a lot of aspects of the Islam and the way it's treated in the US, and sort of he's very unextremist, and in fact he's an apostate. He calls himself an apostate because he doesn't believe, he and almost an unbeliever, because of things that happened in his life and the way he was brought up. Probably the main scene in this 90-minute piece is a dinner party where we've sort of built up this idea of him being almost an unbeliever, very sceptical about Islam and trying to be very, very Western. He drinks, they're going to cook pork at this dinner party that they're about to do. The dinner party is with his colleague from work and her husband, who happens to be a gallery owner who is interested in many ways in Amir's wife, Emily. This is where everything gets shown into the open, and we get a rather brutal ending to the party, and then you get a final wrap-up scene where lots of things have changed in his life and you're not sure where he's going to go. I found this very, very effective, really, this play. It's extremely well acted, and I was impressed by this, but I'm not sure I really loved it or really found it great. I mean, of course, you've got somebody like Kirsty Bushell in it, who's always worth watching, and the rest of the cast are pretty much excellent, and Harry Dillon was very impressive as this person who goes through this journey from being sort of an unbeliever to seeing the consequences of sort of not taking sides and eventually taking sides, which is or taking a side, although probably not completely taking a proper side by the end of it. Paul, what did you think about this?
Well, I think there was a couple of things that really struck me about this play. The first was how very topical it is, given the recent events in Woolwich and, you know, the ongoing war on terror that is taking place. So there's that element of it that you do feel that this round the table discussion could take place in a number of places right now. So it felt very current. The other thing, though, about it was, you know, it's one of those sort of New York plays that you wish they'd do the equivalent of here in the UK, that sort of, you know, takes a gallery owner who's Jewish, his wife who's black, and, you know, another guy who's Muslim but he's not practicing, and his white wife, and, you know, you just start putting these things together, and over the course of a dinner party, everything unravels. And on one aspect, I sort of felt by the end of the play, I was thinking, this is actually quite depressing. But on the other hand, I was thinking, well, actually, it was very cathartic as well. And all the characters, I think, by the end of the piece, had sort of a moment of realization where they actually decide to go their separate ways for various reasons. But I think the fascinating thing about the play is how just small gestures that each of them do have much more significant consequences, and without giving anything of the play away. I think that's what's fascinating about how the play evolves, plus the fact that there's some extraordinary dialogue throughout the piece, and it's, you know, for the entire 90 minutes, it's never dull or boring, and it's got some quite interesting things to say, I think, about present-day living.
Gareth, what did you think of Disgraced?
I quite liked it, but I'm not raving about it in the same way as a lot of the critics are raving about it. And I think largely because I felt it was somewhat contrived and I felt I was being manipulated. I mean, he throws in an awful lot of different themes. You know, there's the sort of post 9/11 attitude to Muslims in America. There's also the kind of the thing around the ingrained things in our youth stay with us forever. There's the radicalization issue. There's a sort of race issue. I mean, I just felt he was trying to achieve too much in a fairly short period of time. And each of the setups, you could kind of see them coming in a way, really. So I admired it, but I didn't really like it. There was no warmth to it. It was sort of very cold and clinical and very manipulative and a bit cynical, really. And therefore, I had no kind of empathy with anybody or indeed with the play. I just admired the acting, admired some of the sort of writing. I certainly admired the set, although the sight lines in the bush on this occasion I thought were really quite poor because it's on the floor and you're sitting around it. I mean, I was missing quite a large chunk in the third row. So I suppose it was a sort of solid 3-star play for me, really, but certainly not the Pulitzer Prize winning rave that it seems to lots of other people to be.
We're now going to talk about The Strange Interlude, which is a Eugene O'Neill play, first written in 1923, but not produced until 1928. It's directed by Simon Godwin and stars Anne-Marie Duff, Charles Edwards, Jason Watkins and Darren Petty, amongst other people. But those are the main characters. I mean, Anne-Marie Duff plays Nina Leeds. She's daughter of a professor. She gets fixated on her first love, named Gordon, who is killed in World War One. And really, it's his image haunts her throughout the rest of the play. Along with that, we have Charles Edwards as Charles Marsden, who's a kind of family friend who's always had a... He's always had a bit of a crush on Nina, but he's that much older than she is. We're not entirely sure, but probably sort of somewhere between 15 and 20 years, I reckon. Then we have Jason Watkins, Sam Evans. He's a slightly hapless character at first, and was a good friend of Gordon. Then Darren Petty plays Edmund Darrell, who is a strong, handsome, sensible doctor who Nina goes to work for him for a while. He's also a friend or an acquaintance of Gordon and tries to help her out after she loses her fiancé. And it doesn't go entirely well. She goes a little bit crazy when she's a nurse, becoming a little bit too sexually active, shall we say. But she settles down and eventually has a child, but there's some mystery regarding that child's, shall we say, that child's parentage. We then look over the next 20 or so years as she's sort of bringing up the child, her marriage, and the various other relationships she has with these three men. The 20 years we go over, though, is very much seen from an early 20s perspective. It's almost as if they are frozen in time. A lot of the references to things. It's still sort of 1928, although, you know, by the time you get to the end of the play, it's sort of 1948. Now, obviously, he wrote it then, Eugene O'Neill wrote it then, so it can't really go beyond into the future. It's not like it's science fiction, but you very much feel you're still in the 1920s in sort of 20 years later. Actors start a little bit too old because they really get them suitable for their ages when they in the later parts of the play. So they all look a little bit superannuated, trying to be 19 or 20 or in their early 20s around then. And it doesn't entirely work, but it is quite good fun to see them. One of the techniques used in this quite a lot is using extended sides, rather like you might see in Shakespeare, or more often in Restoration comedy, where people look at the audience and tell you their true feelings. It's not really a soliloquy, which I have seen it described as in one or two places. It's very much like that aside. It's very, you know, reminded me an awful lot of Restoration theatre, the way they do that. And it's often that discrepancy between what they're saying and what they're meaning, and that kind of aside, it does bring up quite a lot of laughter. And that's again, that's what made me think of Restoration comedy specifically, where the aside is often used for comic effect. I'm not entirely sure that the laughter was entirely suitable for this play. I have a feeling it's meant to be much more serious than that. Very impressive rotating set by Sutra Gilmore for the first few scenes, and then it sort of breaks into a plush New York apartment, which gets broken down rather interestingly and turned and sort of becomes almost from nowhere becomes a yacht for one of the scenes. That actually got applause from the audience, although the yacht wasn't that impressive, but it was quite impressive the way they took down the set. It was
desperation at that point in time for something really funny to happen, or great or exciting.
Okay, now I thought Edwards, Charles Edwards, I like a lot, and I thought he was very good in this. I'm not really a fan of Anne-Marie Duff, but she was fine, and it was very good to see Jason Watkins, who you long been a favourite actor of mine, but I haven't seen him enough in the theatre recently. Now, Phil, what did you think about this?
Well, I approached it with huge trepidation because I knew nothing about it. I knew nothing about the plot, and that's why we're being very careful not to give any too much away about it, because I'd heard that when it was first put on, it was about 5 hours long, and the National's got a 6:30 start time, which suggests it's going to be a very long haul in the theatre, and it turned out to be not a long haul at all. I absolutely loved it. It may be what Eugene O'Neill intended, because to me it played out very much as a comedy, certainly as it went on, once you get after the first establishing scene. The plot, there's a lot of plot, which worked well for me. It's quite melodramatic. It's almost a bit like a soap opera in some ways. But what I wasn't expecting, and I didn't know about this this sort of the conceit of the asides to the audience, but they are very funny. I'd only seen Passion Play a few days earlier, which has sort of got the same conceit going, although, of course, every character in Strange Interlude says what's on their mind. And as you say, they're not soliloquies. They're just sort of, sometimes they're just one line or something, what they're thinking. And Charles Edwards' character has these sort of inner arguments with himself sometimes, which were very funny. I thought it was completely absorbing. I didn't know what was going to happen, but I wanted to know what was going to happen. And I actually cared about the characters, although some of the characters are really not very sympathetic. Some of the things they do are quite dodgy. And yet I was with them. I think that Nina's character, it's a difficult one on her, because is she being selfless or is she being selfish? Is she doing everything for her own good or is she doing it for the good of her family? I thought that was an interesting dilemma. And although some of the choices she makes are strange, you could almost argue for her in this, I think. One of the things I really wasn't expecting, though, was the fact that it was really very comic. I thought the four lead players in her and her potential three suitors were all brilliant. Charles Edwards particularly. I really, really like him, and I like him even more after this. Thought Anne-Marie Duff, I did like her. I thought she was really sort of charismatic and one. I can never say that word. And Jason Watkins had a very difficult role, I think, because he's aged up more. He's aged down more at the beginning than the others, and as his character progresses from this sort of rather sort of ineffectual fool, he becomes quite successful, which sort of worked for me in a strange way. It seemed unlikely, but I had a slight problem with as you say, the aging up and aging down is a bit strange, because he has a scene with his mother, and they look the same age to me, but I can see why they had to do that. I actually loved this. It was the first preview. It can only get better. It didn't feel like a first preview to me. It was a complete and utter shock as a player. I mean, actually, some of the things are quite shocking. I believe it was banned in certain cities in America when it was first on. And it was obviously quite a sensation as well, because it was made into... There's two film versions of it. One's got Clark Gable in, which was made shortly after the play came out. And also Groucho Marx parodies it in Animal Crackers, I think it is. And I'm going to put the clip of that in the review when it goes up from the Whingers. I can't recommend this too highly, but I think we're going to hear another opinion in a minute.
Yeah, well, this is one of those plays that is why I have post-traumatic stress syndrome that hits any time I open the doors of the Littleton and wonder, how am I going to leap over eight people in order to escape the horrible doom awaiting me? Because from almost the very first moment that the characters started speaking and they started using these asides to address the audience, I felt this real sense of cognitive dissonance that it felt so wrong. And the contrast between what they were saying and then what they would say when they were addressing the other characters, plus the unnaturalness, because the speeches that they gave to the audience were so long. And so I do think soliloquy is appropriate. And the other characters would have to stand there, you know, pretending that they're just not moving while the other person's like talking. It really just drove me up a tree. It grated tremendously, and it made it, I think, quite an unfortunate comedy. I can't believe that what we saw taking place on stage was anything other than a genuine intended tragedy. And instead, what we saw was an unintended tragedy, a comic tragedy. And the woman that I went to see the play with and I both just were holding on by our fingernails to not escape and get out. But we actually wanted to get our money's worth out of our tickets because we thought they were kind of expensive. And for me, I have so many people complain that I don't see three plays through and I can't really speak to them, that I thought, okay, well, I'm going to make it through this one. But if my friend had wanted to go, I would have, because I was hating it, just hating it. And I couldn't buy the acting of any of the people on stage because what they were saying was just so ridiculous. And I can't actually say this was the fault of the actors because much like Jessica Rabbit, it was written that way. And I think that the National has a huge flop on their hands and that they should have considered very seriously how to handle the monologuing so that it wasn't so unintentionally funny, because the audience was in stitches, but I feel that part of that was because of the uncomfortableness of seeing these horrible things happening on stage, these human tragedies playing out before us in this mock serious style. And because we couldn't buy either the tragedy or believe it was in fact intended to be a comedy, we just went ahead and laughed because that was the best way to deal with it. So, Phil, I also had quite a hearty chuckle, and you probably could have heard my guffaws from where I sat, because I just decided to let it go and enjoy what I could do. I did really want to see this play because I consider O'Neill a great playwright, and I wanted to see everything that he's written because some of it is so truly amazing. But this play, Withers on the Vine, I think it cannot hold in this century unless there was a really, really different approach to handling the asides, because they shake things up too much. They do make it funny, and I can't believe that he intended us to laugh, except maybe a little bit at the older man of the three. There's some themes in the play that I think are genuinely worthy of the attention of the theater and of us as theatrical audiences. The questions of happiness and what is worth sacrificing for happiness. The questions of how people handle madness. And for me, the fact that the lead female character was mad genuinely at the beginning of the play, and I think constantly teetering on the edge of madness, is really important to making her the least bit sympathetic, because otherwise she really just comes off as the biggest cretin I've seen in ages. And also the question of how madness was seen from, shall we say, the eugenics point of view. You know, is madness the kind of inheritable disease that is, as was seen in the 20s, vile enough to make it worthwhile to sterilize people? 10 years later, we saw that, you know, played out on the world stage in like a much more vibrant perspective. And I think it's important for us to see these historical point of views, but also think about, you know, what the attitudes of the society were at the time. But I didn't like any of the characters. I wanted to run around slapping them all in the face, telling them to put their big girl shorts on and actually act like respectable human beings and have some strength of character. And none of them did. Regarding the asides, I thought it was interesting, Tim, that you said that they reminded you so much of Restoration comedy, because last night I went and saw The Seagull, and The Seagull actually has quite a few asides where the characters just stand there and quietly talk to the audience. And I felt those asides were so much more appropriately handled. They gave certainly insight into the characters and into their inner turmoil. But for almost every one of them, no other character was on scene while they were talking to us. And it made it not clash so much with what the rest of the action on stage. But, you know, considering the way that that strange interlude went was monologue, one person talking to another person talking back, monologue, you know, it was just really uncomfortable. So I have to say it's going to be up there with Carrie the Musical on the lists of really, really, really horrible plays that I've somehow managed to set my way through. And Phil, it warms my heart that there was somebody in there that actually really enjoyed it, because I didn't think it was possible.
I got the feeling a lot of people in there enjoying it. And actually, do you know what? With all the comedy, I still think that I was ultimately quite moved by it. And there were moments I thought it switched between being comic and actually having some really interesting things. And there's a lot of things going on. And as you say about the discussions, particularly the eugenics and the self-sacrifice, or whether she was being selfish or not. But it's actually some interesting dilemmas that, that the characters face. And I think it still handled all that well, despite having all the comedy. And I think the comedy helped you through it, because it's still 3 hours, 25 minutes. And I wasn't bored for a moment. I mean, I think I do agree with you. At first, I was a bit taken aback by the playing in the first scene, where they have to establish, you know, who the characters are, and the, you know, the aside to the origin at that point, I don't think they'd quite got into their stride with it, but it was the first preview. But as it went on, I think the comedy actually comes in later. It sort of picks up, and then it gets funnier and funnier. Well, for me, it did anyway.
The one character I thought that was genuinely meant to be funny was the one who played the older suitor, because his shtick sort of becomes every time that people are having an intimate moment, he walks on stage. And also the fact that he's so incapable of actually doing any of the things that he thinks about. I do believe that he was meant ultimately to be kind of funny, but you know, for me it was actually almost like watching a Chekhov, because I didn't like the characters. Did you even think that the character of the son, you didn't find him a little wooden?
Well, the son, the adult. I think by then the thing is, if I'm really enjoying something, I kind of can go with the whole thing. I didn't find him wooden. I mean, his part is quite small anyway. He comes on quite late in the play. Yeah. It didn't affect it for me. I thought he was perfectly fine.
Good to hear. I have to say, because so many things have been going wrong during the entire show, I mean, just one catastrophe after another, that in like the very last scene, I expected God's finger to rise out from the sky and smite the sun, just so that the entire thing could have ultimately been proven to be worthless, and that all of her sacrifices had ultimately been for nothing. I guess O'Neill didn't have my sense of humor.
I think it shows that Judeo had a great sense of humor. I think it's probably some of it was definitely meant to be funny. I think the director obviously gone for the comedy and really played it up. And for me, that worked. It obviously didn't work for you.
No. All right, Phil, next time there's an O'Neill play on, let's go together.
I want to see all of the O'Neills now. It's really, I loved the last production of Long Day's Journey Into Night, and I loved the Iceman Cameth when I saw it with Spacey. I want to see the whole canon now, I think.
All right. Well, I'm definitely going to go with you to the next one that comes up, because I'd like to be able to get some feedback during the night. And who knows, maybe we'll both hate it or we'll both love it.
Tim, where did you fall in this?
I certainly enjoyed it. I don't know that if it was meant to be serious, then yes, they got a disaster on their hands because it's too funny. I also had a slight problem with the way that they aged the actors. It was sort of the actors ended up far too old, which I may have mentioned. I mean, Nina should be in her early 50s at the latest at the end of the play, and she was playing it about 60, as far as I could see. You know,
well, I was a bit confused by the whole time span. But it didn't spoil it for me. And I didn't realise that it was going to cover all that period of time, because when there's the scene in I think it's the second scene between Sam and his mother, that I was very confused why they looked the same age, but I understood it later. Except she's only in that scene, so why didn't they have an older actress? Because it would have worked kind of better against him. Because I didn't realise he was meant to be aged down, but the strange wig that he had on was obviously meant to make him look younger, but it didn't really. Certainly not for the front row, anyway. The set, I thought it's quite unusual, because I thought we were sort of going to stay with that revolve throughout. And when it sort of disappeared and the sets almost took off, a bit like the play did in a way, it sort of reflected the play quite well. It just took off in a completely different other direction. Because considering it's a huge stage, we were very confined to quite small rooms for the until the interval, which seemed we weren't really making use of that huge space, which they do in the second act. But because I was in the front row and quite near the centre, it was a great view, except for the set that got the applause, which was a bit odd, because it didn't look very good from the front. It was a bad sight lines for that one, because it was very high up, but still didn't spoil the evening for me.
How much has it been cut down? Does anybody know? Because I mean,
the original running time was 5 hours.
Yeah,
so.
but where has it been cut down? Because I did feel that it was the second half where the cuts were made.
Well, I wonder that because there are some sort of jumps in time, but I don't know whether that's in the plan. You know, I wouldn't want to see the 5 hour version of this, even with the dinner break, which apparently had. Or sometimes I think it was played over two evenings, which is quite worrying. I mean, I think you wouldn't get people to go back for the second act if people came out feeling like Tom Vane did.
They made a film. They made a film of the one that starred Glenda Jackson. There was a West End production starring Glenda Jackson in the '80s, and they filmed that one. Apparently, has a short. Kenneth Branagh plays his son in that. And it's available on VHS. It's not available on DVD. And we really have to start. I think we have to start a campaign because I definitely want to see that.
Yeah, I think that production went to Broadway as well. I think it transferred.
Well, I'll sit that movie party out.
I want to see it live because I just think it's something it's very theatrical. The whole conceit is theatrical. So I don't know whether that would work on film. When I eventually get the review up and you see this Marx Brothers clip, it's you do.
I'm so watching the Marx Brothers thing because to me it felt like a parody of a parody. I felt like I was watching the 39 Steps.
We're now going to talk about The Seagull, which is a Headlong production, which toured at the Richmond last week and is touring for another couple of weeks elsewhere. It's the play by Anton Chekhov. It's a new version by playwright John Donnelly and directed by Blanche McIntyre. David Beams as Evgeny, Pearl Chandler as Nina, Alexander Cobb as Konstantin, Abigail Cruttendon as Irina, Catherine Cusack as Polina, Rudy Dharma Lingam as Semyon, John Elkington as Ilya, Eddie Eyre as Yakov, Colin Haig as Pitya, Jenny Rainsford as Masha, and Yuri Sirossi as Boris. This is actually a very squarey modern dress production. Although, actually, the setting although they're wearing modern dress and speaking in a modern fashion, the setting still feels very much the 1890s or the early 1900s. I mean, they're still talking about getting the coaches and horses. They're not talking about anything modern, although he is given a modern magazine. This compares with about 6 months ago, the Southwark Playhouse did a version of The Seagull written by Anya Rees, and she completely modernised it, so it was set in the Isle of Man. It was a very much more of an adaptation. This, although it's it uses a modern language, this production it feels very much more in the spirit of The Seagull. It doesn't feel as much of an adaptation as the other one was. The set here is very simple and effective. I mean, really basing it around a platform which can act as a table or a seesaw or a sort of the dock overlooking the large lake which we have in The Seagull. I'm not sure if we need to go over the plot for The Seagull. Essentially, it's about a young man and his young man Konstantin and his relationship with his mother, who has a younger lover. He's in love with a girl called Nina, but she falls for somebody else and goes away, and it doesn't end happily. There's a rather effective piece of setting here, as well as the platform that they use, the seesaw platform, the backdrop is it's either felt or blotting paper or some kind of paper, and they spray water on it to put up scene in a way to do scenery. So people will draw a picture of the sun and a few birds and a sort of a horizon. In the end scene, we see Konstantin's writing as he is sort of trying to become a writer. And there's a very effective part of that is the scene, as his scene with Nina progresses, this final scene where he really discovers that although he still holds a candle for her, she's not interested in him. And as that happens, it's raining outside, and the water begins to dribble down this blotting paper or felt, and his writing that he's written on very quickly at the beginning of the scene disappears, and it's sort of obliterated, and it's sort of that idea of his world falling apart, which I found particularly effective in this. I think it's very well performed. I mean, David Beams is as the Doctor Evgeny was very impressive. Yuri Sirossi as Trigorin. Usually Trigorin is a sort of rather very much a a man who knows what he's doing, but Yuri Taraschi plays a very weak Trigorin. He's not very sure, he's not very confident, and there is a particularly impressive scene where Abigail Cruttendon, as his as Arcadna, the actress, sort of gussies herself up to perform a seduction on him in about 3 minutes flat. She hasn't got much time to do it, and you get the feeling that it's a sort of an express seduction on her part, and it was rather impressive, I thought, that particular scene. But it's a very, very effective production, and I was very impressed by it. I wasn't looking forward to it. I don't usually look forward to Chekhov in this way, but this one is particularly good, and that's why I think it's worth talking about. Now, this was your second Chekhov of the week, wasn't it, Webcow Girl?
Yes, because the day before I'd gone off to the Arkala to see Platonov, a.k.a. Sons Without Fathers. I dislike Chekhov and usually avoid seeing productions of his plays because the characters are so irritating, indecisive, and whiny that I want to run around on the stage and slap all of them, much like another play I saw earlier this week. But I have to say, after seeing O'Neill, Chimerica, and two Chekhovs in 1 week, I am utterly convinced of Chekhov's genius as a writer. I'm sure he doesn't need my approval in any way, but for all that I don't like his plotting, the way that he is able to express and create believable human beings on stage, people who, when you see them speaking, you can see their past in your head and you just completely believe them, is amazing. In the Platonov, I forgot I was watching actors. The intensity of the emotions that they were experiencing, and of course it's such a very small stage, and the way that they were so tightly entwined with each other, I watched their faces and I thought about their thoughts, and of course their actual thoughts were, what do I say in my next scene and how do I hold myself? But instead, I felt that I was seeing Russians, people from a completely different society from 100 years ago. And for The Seagull, set in modern times, I didn't care that they had thrown in that bit about the coach and horses. Although I have to say, considering the extraordinarily foul language, which during the presentation of the play in the first act, there was no way to get around the fact that that all felt very modern. I had to listen to some people complain about it during the interval, and they were saying, I don't believe they were following like this Chekhov script, and they just took all sorts of liberties. But I actually think that the way that they did it made it feel very good and very realistic, and especially considering that part of the whole point of that play is that it's so bad that the use of the bad language kind of emphasized that little play's desire to be shocking to the bourgeois, and it succeeded, which is pretty good. So I went to see The Seagull despite hating Chekhov because it was actually on Lynn Gardner's list of tips some time back, and Richmond is actually, obviously quite a bit closer to London than any of the other places that it's in. Apparently it's going to be revving up at the Theatre Royal Bath on the 4th, and then it's going to Derby for a nice long run, and I think the folks really ought to get out and see this show if they want to see an excellent production of what I think is Chekhov's best play. It's a little, self-indulgent since it's about playwrights, two characters that are playwrights and two characters, that are actresses. So he's definitely writing for the home crowd. In fact, I almost felt like that there was a little aside at Michael Billington as I was listening to the characters speak last night and complain about critics who only want to hear people talk about politics on stage. This is a play that is entirely about the journeys of the heart and of individual aspiration and of dreams. And it's a play about love and people. There's obviously the love of a son for his mother, but then so many unrequited loves. And each of the characters was so fully realized, even the sort of foolish character of the teacher who's treated with such ridiculousness, so ridiculous by his wife. But it was beautiful, and the way that it was so utterly stripped down with nothing but that giant wooden, you know, trestle slash teeter-totter in the middle of the stage, it was a genius stroke to call into greater relief the incredible drama that was being played out. Now, towards the end of this play, well, things do get really bleak, and I think the running time was about 2.5 hours, and the other people who were with me began to fade, because it's difficult watching these people being simultaneously miserable and trivial. And yet, my God, I just thought it was really very good. And I think you will be hard pressed throughout the course of your lifetime to see a better Seagull than Headlong presented last night. It was really just about perfect. You're right about the set, the bit with the way that his writing faded away. The way that I saw it was that it was his life and his dreams fading away, and his hopes turning into nothingness. But I completely missed that it was the rain that was doing it. I was looking so hard at the people on the set that I wasn't looking at the backdrop anymore. But in some ways, that simple backdrop, you know, it made it easier to focus. Oh my God, though, the scene where it's Irina, right, goes for it's Boris to pull him back into her, that was hysterical. And she was a fantastic actress. She really had that character down.
Yeah, I've seen Forever Girl kind of Crafton in plenty of things, and this is easily the best thing I've ever seen her in. It was very impressive.
We were able to see it for a mere £11 last night, and we got upgraded from the top of the circles into the dress circle. And I, you know, thought it was a bit of a shame that the theater wasn't more full, because you couldn't ask for anything better. On the other hand, I've seen all the Chekhov I need to see for the rest of the year. I'm done now.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast page in Facebook. On the web, we are ayultp.com, and the podcast will also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.